So I'm Rick Hansen. It's July 12th, right, 2017. And when you travel, you kind of lose like, oh, it's Thursday, I must be in Boston or something like that. As you probably know, this year we're focusing on relationships as a field of practice and as support for practice. And I want to begin a kind of sequence that is about dealing with conflicts and issues. Quarrels, feeling hurt, feeling let down, forgiveness, grappling with wounds, including fairly serious wounds in relationships. What might the Dharma have to offer about those topics? Also, the Dharma, in harmony with and perhaps informed by, augmented by in some ways, 2,500 years of study of relationships, including recently in psychology and neuroscience. So that's kind of the territory. I think it's easy to be really loving and happy with people when you're getting a mani-pedi and, they're fluffing your hair and, giving you like IV chocolate. And it's all really good, right? But what happens when we're in conflict with other people? When we want X and they want Y? Or, we produce a beautiful book and I'm sorry, this will come. You get a one-star review on Amazon because there was a problem with the Kindle technology that had nothing to do with your own book, right? What do you do with that, right? And other issues even much larger than that, including scaled-up political issues. How do we think about a larger issues where groups are in conflict with each other or where, as many people do, we have serious issues with leadership in a particular country? How do we manage that, broadly defined, right? So that's kind of the territory I hope to explore, area of difficulty. So I'm going to enter into it kind of now. So as a foundation, as a way into looking at this, I want to just quickly review what in Buddhism are considered to be the three fundamental pillars of practice. And these are framed as three supports for a life of practice that is increasingly less saturated with suffering and is increasingly full of happiness, love, wisdom, and peace on the way to, certainly in the Buddha's ambitions, his aims for people, on the way to awakening, including potentially all the way there. So these are these three great supports for a life of practice, and they are concentration, in Sanskrit, samadhi, being able to focus attention and rest attention and steady the mind, even to the point of deep, deep concentrated states that open into non-ordinary states of awareness. So we have the samadhi pillar of practice, concentrating the mind, training the mind, steadying the mind, getting regulatory control over our attention, which William James, the godfather of psychology in America, said the education of attention would be the education par excellence, in part because what we rest our attention upon gets sucked into our brain. So you can see the fundamental importance of this territory, this pillar of practice, which of course involves, multiple things. Samadhi or concentration pillar of practice. Second major pillar of practice of the three is wisdom. In Sanskrit or Pali, the language of early Buddhism, panya, wisdom, insight, recognition of impermanence, understanding of cause and effect, practical wisdom, learning how to speak wisely, learning how to act wisely with other people, even wisdom into the depths of our own psyche, understanding the layered nature of the psyche and the way that how we feel here and now is shaped by our previous experiences. Wisdom about other people, wisdom that certain words or certain tones or certain actions really hit other people hard, really land hard on other people. On the other hand, wisdom that understands if I speak in different ways, if I act in different ways, if I take certain things into account, understandably in the minds of others, things go better. Panya, wisdom. Then the last pillar of practice, sometimes translated as virtue or morality, is sila, which also means restraint. And it's easy to think about sila, restraint, morality, virtue in kind of a classic Judeo-Christian or Abrahamic traditional sense, bringing Islam into it, in terms of shoulds handed down from on high. That's not the way the Buddha meant sila, restraint, morality, virtue. He meant it very pragmatically as worth doing, not in terms of some kind of commandment from a higher power that's laid down the law. Whether or not such a higher power exists is a very different question. But in the frame of Buddhism, at least, the sila, pillar of practice, is very pragmatic. It's based on a view, which, like everything in Buddhism, people are to see for themselves, that restraining harms to others, restraining harms to ourselves, acting in ways that have virtuous qualities with them, in particular, restraining problematic behaviors, but also generating beneficial behaviors, the whole territory of virtue and morality, is done for whatever benefit it may have in terms of, you know, some kind of universal standards. It's done because it helps. It helps our own movement toward the path of down the path of awakening. It helps reduce suffering. It helps increase happiness for ourselves and other people to conduct ourselves in virtuous ways. Okay. So then, now, zeroing in on the sila, pillar of practice, how do we know it's virtuous? How do we know it's good instead of bad? Right? How do we know that it's helpful instead of harmful? How do we think about that? Including, how do we sort it out when other people, let's say, come at us and say, what you did was really bad, and inside ourselves we think, you know, it was actually good, or it was neutral. You know, it was good that I spoke up in that way. It was good that I called you on your stuff. It was perfectly fine that I went out and listened to music with my friends till midnight. You know, that was okay. Like, in other words, how do we determine? Or maybe somebody says, you know, I forgive you for something. And we think to ourselves, forgiveness? Like, why do I deserve your forgiveness? Or flip it around, maybe we say to somebody, you know, I forgive you for that. Or I'm trying to forgive you for that. And their response to us is, you know, who do you think you are that, you know, I need your forgiveness? So how do we work that out? So I want to offer a kind of a framework, also as a way in to considering really pretty, you know, tough issues with other people. When should parents exercise power over their children? When is it moral and appropriate and virtuous and wise to do that? How do we sort out how other people affect us and bring some clarity to our, you know, reactions, let's say, of anger or resentment or grievance? How do we filter through that and basically leave to the side needless righteousness, needless fault-finding? And yet, on the other hand, how do we sort out what actually is justice, what actually is fair and appropriate, and what actually is appropriate to take one's own stand in, especially if one tends to kind of give others more credit than oneself, or if one tends to you know, not stand up for one's own deep inner sense that, hey, I was mistreated here, or hey, you know, I do deserve better from you than I got. How do we actually know that? Right? How do we come to some kind of clarity about that? So I want to offer some ways into that, laid out at your feet, as it were, for you to see for yourself, and then we can kind of open it up. So one way into these questions is very grounded and very embodied in our biology. Our biology, the fact of having a body. It's kind of where we all start, you know. The great family therapist Virginia Satir would do workshops, and she would do things like she would have people bump into each other with their navels, right? Because that's the fundamental universal basis for being human. We all have a belly button, right? You know, there's like a joke about two archaeologists discovered two ancient bodies in some amazing tomb, and they took a quick look at the bodies and said, oh, that's, you know, Adam and Eve. And the other person said, how do you know that? Well, they have no belly button. Right, they were just created out of whole cloth. Right, so that's like a kind of an old joke. Anyway, so maybe I thought everyone knew that joke, but so it seemed really funny to me when I was in seventh grade, or I don't know. It's like a junior high school joke. Anyway, so you know the universalness of the body. So the body, we kind of start there. So what's good and what's bad can be understood very fundamentally in terms of biology. What promotes survival, what promotes the thriving, the passing on of genes, the pass on genes of particular species. And the thriving and surviving of the body really boils down to satisfying one way or another, hopefully more skillfully than not, three fundamental needs. So whether it's a lizard, a mouse, or a monkey, or a human being sitting in this room right now, the body needs to be safe. The body needs to be not attacked in the moment by a predator, right? The body needs to not be burning up in a building. The body needs to be not infected with an illness. The body needs to be not toxified with something that's harmful or poisonous, right? The body. And in related ways, the mind, the feelings of a person, their own sense of you know, their place in life, you know, has a fundamental need in terms of not being in pain or having the threat of pain. So right here we have a fundamental referent. Safety. Is something creating more or less safety for ourselves or other people? Now we might argue about, you know, what does it mean to be safe? We might argue about, you know, your definition of safety is different from my definition of safety. I'm trying to kind of go underneath those arguments to a fundamental standard related to safety. So we can immediately consider our relations with others. Wow, in that relationship, am I increasing or decreasing the safety, the physical and psychological safety of my partner, my roommates, my friends, my community, the safety of my neighbors, and then edging farther and farther out, the whole human tribe and life and the planet altogether. Am I increasing or decreasing safety? Turn it around, are other people increasing or decreasing my safety? Are they creating pain for me? Are they bringing threats at me? Are their threats appropriate? Warning me that, you know, if I keep smoking three packs a day, you know, that won't be good for my health. I don't smoke. My mother-in-law was a three-pack-a-day smoker. She then had a stroke, as it turned out, and she went into the hospital, and she didn't like having a stroke at all. She made actually a full recovery after about a week of rehab. And as she was leaving the hospital as a 75-year-old three-pack-a-day smoker, she said, asked the doctor, so can I continue smoking? Can I start smoking again? Because she hadn't smoked for a week. You know, nothing like a stroke to help you kick smoking for a week. And interestingly, as one of these studies show, her stroke actually was in one of the reward centers of the brain, so she didn't crave cigarettes. So at that point, her desire to smoke was more based on habit than some kind of biologically grounded craving. It's actually true. And so the doctor nodded and smiled and said, sure, you can start smoking again. Pause, if you want another stroke. Okay. Right. So harmful for her own safety, quite objectively. So that's one fundamental referent. And it's interesting to evaluate quarrels or issues with other people and run them through the filter of safety. You know, their grievances coming this way, their complaints or unmet needs coming this way, grievances, unmet needs, complaints toward them, to what extent are they clarified if we run them through the filter of safety, including very, very fundamental forms of safety. Second need of any animal, even a little worm, is for reward or satisfaction, most primarily food. We need to eat. So much about early Buddhism is about the fundamental process of offering food or receiving food. And there are some beautiful lines where the Buddha says, I'm quoting roughly from memory, if you knew what I knew about the benefits of generosity, he says, you would never, ever have a single meal without offering some of it to others. Wow, very fundamental. You know, one of the most unusual and remarkable things about human beings and a few other, to some extent, our primate ancestors, is the offering of food to others. You know, most animals, they don't share food, particularly outside their immediate, you know, children or family. In most animal species, the males of the species never bring food home to their own children, even if they're mated with a partner reliably, even in primate species. And so the offering of food and the sharing of food is very fundamental. We help others to be satisfied. We help ourselves to be satisfied. We have needs for satisfaction that have to do with a sense of agency, being able to accomplish goals, right? When our need to accomplish goals of various kinds is repeatedly thwarted, that's very upsetting and psychologically damaging, whether it's a human being or a much less complex other animal. People have a basic need for a certain amount of pleasure, for a certain amount of enjoyment. Otherwise, life starts feeling very empty, and neutral is depressing. Nothing but neutral is negative. Right? We have a need for satisfaction, for goal attainment. And then third key need, met in various kinds of ways, depending on the complexity of the biology, is for connection. Minimally sex, worms, frogs, you know, crabs, I have no idea how they do it, scaled all the way up, humans. We're very, very profoundly social. Primates, social mammals. One of the major theories of the evolution of the brain last several million years is that it has been driven by the primary adaptation of the human species, which is to group living. Throughout almost all of the history of our species, roughly 200,000, now increasingly pushed back around 300,000 years, and our ancestors, our hominid and then primate ancestors, was living in small bands of about 30 adults. In this room, there are more than 30 adults. This would be a large band. We would live together, most of us living together our entire lives, living mainly within 100 miles, probably less, from where we were born. This is it, with another couple dozen children running around the edges. That's a band. This is how we would function. And we are highly adapted to cooperative living inside bands of this sort, competing intensely, often aggressively, sometimes cooperating, but often competing with other bands for scarce resources, including during periods of intense climate change produced through natural causes. So we have an intense need for connection, for love, to receive love, to give love. I think one of the great wounds for people is thwarted love, you know, not having a vehicle into which they can give their love. One of the, cruelest things that people can do to each other is to shun them or exile them or act like they don't exist. Studies on young children with their caregivers who just look at them with a poker face were halted fairly quickly because the infants and toddlers just broke down. They couldn't tolerate their mother or father sitting across from them and just staring at them with a completely blank expression. It's so devastating to be in that environment. So again, think about relationship issues. Through the lens of first satisfaction, are we thwarting the aims and goals of others? Studies on children, young children, show that roughly half the parental interventions are unnecessary on average. Some parents are on the side of just letting, you know, anything happen, but on average, there are roughly about half of all interventions, reasonable people could look and go, you didn't need to do that. And in the life of a toddler or preschooler, They average about 20 an hour, 20 an hour. Yeah, every 2 or 3 minutes, there's some kind of thwarting of the wants of a child on average. Imagine being at work and 20 times an hour, someone stops you from getting what you want, or if you ask people for something that you want that's reasonable, they ignore you or don't help you, right? Or get in the way. Like, how would that feel? So we have needs for satisfaction. Others have needs for satisfaction. That's a lens through which we can look at what is good or bad. Same with connection. We have needs to give love and receive love. And it's really interesting to ask ourselves in terms of connection, if others make bids for contact, how do we respond? Do we step back? Now, maybe we need to step back. Maybe their bid for contact is bad because it's not safe. Or maybe it violates our own needs for satisfaction in the moment. It gets in the way of our own goal pursuits. But very often, the bids for contact from others, including pulling for what are called narcissistic supplies of reassurance or mirroring, attunement, empathy, as well as perhaps praise or acknowledgement, respect, even prizing. You know, very often we could give them that. Flip it around, very often they could give that to us. And it's in the breaching of that need, it's in light of that need not being fulfilled that something is problematic. Okay? So you see this way of looking at it so far? Right, is how do we decide whether it's good or bad? Well, one way to do it, one way, philosophers work these theories out more elaborately than I'm doing right now, but one way to look at it is in terms of our absolute grounded physical biological nature and the three fundamental needs of any living creature, any animal certainly, for safety, satisfaction, and connection. And then just to finish here, I want to add two more kinds of standards to use or two more touchstones. The fourth one is it true? In other words, fundamentally, are we a stand ourselves for what's true, and do we respect the desire of others to get to the bottom of what really happened? Flip the other way, are we with people, sometimes scaled up all the way to political leadership, that is not committed to finding out whatever the facts actually are and is in fact committed to obstructing the discovery of whatever is true. Or scaled down to the level of teenagers or children we're raising, you know, are they trying to spin us or do they actually have a commitment to truth as well? You know, that's a fundamental basis for morality, you know, a commitment to whatever the facts are, recognizing we're fallible. People can describe facts in different ways, but at the end of the day, or someone once asked me, gee, Dad, how do I know that I've raked all the leaves? Because I was going to give him $1, I think, for raking all the leaves. And I was like, well, when there are no more leaves, right? Or the kid, you know, like with chocolate chips smeared all over their face and there are no more cookies in the cookie jar. And, well, you know, did you take the cookies out of the cookie jar? Often is kind of pretty clear what's actually true. And then the last touchstone or standard for establishing what is virtue, what is sila, what is a basis upon which then we can talk about conflicts or issues with other people is what the philosopher Hegel described with this fancy term, the categorical imperative, which is this basic idea that as a foundation of any kind of ethical principle, that we are willing for it to be applied to us if we are going to apply it to others. Flip it around, we call others to live by the same standards and that they try to make us live by, and that if others claim various privileges to themselves, those privileges apply to us too. In other words, fairness, fair play. It's kind of very fundamental. The last two, after the three needs, the last two basically are you committed to what's true, and are you committed to being fair? And if a person isn't, that's a fundamental issue right off the top, right? Flip it around, you know, other people might ask us, hey, how committed to truth are we, actually? Including copping to our own responsibility, fessing up, the Buddha really emphasized the virtuous willingness of people on the path to be, as he said, admonishable. It's a tricky word, but in other words, it means that we're willing for others to say, you know, I see cookies all over your face. You know, you said you ate the leaves and you didn't. You know, that's the way it is. We have to be willing to be on the receiving end of that. So I'm going to wrap up now. So think about those as kind of five touchstones, ways of really not doing this at a philosophical level, but really looking at important relationships. In terms of key people, you might think of a key person in your life or a handful of key people. Am I doing what I could and what I want to support the safety of my partner, my friend, my world? Am I doing what I could and what I want to support the satisfaction, the goal attainment, the success, the pleasure of my partner, my friend, my community? And also, am I responding reasonably to the yearnings for connection, the longings for love from other people? And flip it around, am I willing to stand up for those needs myself that I have too? And then last, just kind of as a bit of clarity at the end, you know, is there a commitment to truth and is there a commitment to justice? Is there a commitment to a fairness that applies to all parties as well? Okay, so what do you think about all that? What do you think about all that as kind of foundational? And as a way to look at and to have moral confidence, you know, to go, you know, these parts, you're right. I blew it. I'm going to implement some correction. That one thing, I do feel I deserve healthy remorse for that. Okay? That's for real. You know, then we can be at peace because we're rested in a sense of clarity. Flip the other way. You know, as we look at certain relationships where people are blowing us off or just in our gut, we know, we feel something's awry, something's wonky. They're spinning us really well. They're telling us a good story, but every time we walk away, we feel kind of weird or bad or less than. Something's off. These five touchstones give us a way to look at that sort of situation too. Okay. Questions, comments so far?
In grandparenting, you're dealing with what I understand is a complete and utter narcissist until age 6. Is that correct?
You mean like a little kid? Yeah, often people use the word egocentric. It's not so charged as narcissist,
so,
but self-referential. You know,
different.
But it doesn't mean they're sociopaths. You know? Okay. Yeah.
Somebody did.
So well, me. You know. Okay.
I don't remember who it was. Children are criminals. But anyway, are the standards all different?
You know, oh, that's very interesting.
Really,
yeah, I hear you.
We're experiencing that and loving it and you know, going overboard with some more than perhaps some would say is beneficial.
If I follow you correctly, asking about kids, and I've worked a lot with kids, yeah, including really little kids, like little, like 15-month-old little, or 4-year-old little. All right. So first of all, again, they have certain needs, right? So thinking about the needs of the child in a really serious way, including a child's subtler needs for relational supplies, you know, that to me is a way to look at, you know, through these three lenses, the needs of a young child for safety, satisfaction, and subtleties of connection. Flip the other way, for us to keep meeting their needs, including to keep meeting their needs as members of our tribe, our band. You know, if we start running on empty ourselves, we can't take care of them. Yeah? So I think that's a way to look at it. And then also, you know, you take a kid out to a fancy restaurant, the kid's screaming and yelling the whole time. That's kind of invasive for the needs of other people. They have needs, I think, for satisfaction, let's say, and also relatedness with their partner, something to think about. And then last, I think it's completely okay, in my personal opinion, to be a sustained stand for truth and fairness. You know, I think the fundamental basis of the common good is irreducibly a fundamental commitment to telling the truth and to being fair. Rules for you or rules for me, privileges for me or privileges for you. writes for me or writes for you or burden, you know, burdens for you or burdens for me. I mean, that's really, to me, fundamental. And then the only question is really the application of that. What's the age-appropriate application of a commitment to truth and to fairness, and how do we help, you know, socialize and educate young children around, you know, the values, really, the values here. So you decide for yourself.
Cannot think in terms of
fears. Oh, kids, no, I disagree. I want to keep moving. But now kids have this intense sense of fairness. No, rats have a sense of fairness. Like, literally, they'll do things with rat studies. Like, you got a piece of candy and I didn't? You know, forget that. Like, rats get mad at that. So there's a kind of primal sense of fairness. So I'm going to keep going here, but I think I'll finish on this point, knowing you. And the grandmother, I think your grandkids are lucky in their choice of grandparents. All right, whoop, Tom.
Yeah, you brought up the truth. I often find myself wondering, why am I in this tug of war with someone about the truth?
Mm.
And I'll hear phrases like, well, such and such is my truth. When I really feel they're saying, this is my opinion.
Yeah.
I understand the difference between facts. Did something occur? Are you wearing a yellow shirt or a blue shirt? But there's a much larger sphere where people, individuals, stand on some claim of truth that isn't in alignment with how I view the world.
Right.
Give me some language to work with that.
Well, as Jean-Paul Sartre said, and you know this quote, hell is other people. You know? So first off, I would say that, you know, and I offer this not in any kind of pushy way. I find this is really, for me at least, has been a very helpful way to observe my own, you know, I would say I it helps me call myself to a higher standard in terms of caring for the safety, satisfaction, and connection of others. And I'm pretty good, I think, on truth and fairness, but it gives me also a way to think about and talk about why I feel so disturbed, you know, these days politically. I've come to believe that the main divide right now in our country and the developed parts of the world is not between liberals and conservatives. It's not that classic divide. That's a reconcilable divide. But when you have two groups that are increasingly not equally committed to truth and to fairness, then you have real issues. And so, you know, so then I think also here just about the Buddha, what would routinely happen, as best we can tell from these discourses that survive, many of them were about these brilliant philosophers who'd roll into the grove and try to take down the big dog, the Buddha. And they'd roll in, they were Brahmanically trained, they were very intelligent, they'd try to tie the Buddha up in knots about truth. And he would tend to just cut through that. And with questions like, are you happy? Did that help? Did that hurt? Are you the only person in your village who's lost someone you love? You know, right? Are you actually becoming wiser through your ritualistic practices or not? Can a woman be just as capable of enlightenment as a man? Yes, for example. So to me, he was really quite relentless in his tendency to cut through what he called a thicket of views to get to some kind of bottom line basics. You know, did you kill? Did you steal? Did you, you know, speak falsely? Did you tell a lie, speaking of truth? Did you harm others through sexuality? Did you intoxicate yourself? Are you addicted to intoxicants of various kinds? These are very direct questions. And I think there's a tendency, in my personal opinion, I mean, I get the postmodern critique of received wisdom and that stuff and multiculturalism, but at the end of the day, a piece of the ice sheet in Antarctica the size of Delaware either separated or it didn't. It did. You know, you see a big gap there where, you know, the ocean is showing up. That's just kind of factually the case, and I tend to get fairly, myself, interested in getting to the bottom line. And there's a truthful question. It's pretty factual. Are you committed to discovering facts or not? And are you willing to bow to facts that counter your own views? And fairly quickly, I want to find out what's up, because in part, if people are not committed to truth or to fairness, it's not safe. It's not safe around them. You know, if you look at one of the fundamental things that goes awry in pathological family systems or problematic relationships, is this attack on the capacity to discern the truth. And also this attack on a kind of equality of standards, that standards for me are standards for you, standards are you for you are standards for me, and so forth. And so I think immediately, you know, that's really pretty problematic, and it's a big flag for me. And again, my point here is not to, I mean, the things we can do politically, mostly what we can do is think about it and form our own clarity. But what we can do a lot is in our intimate relationships with other people, friendships, neighbors, people we see on the street, people we work with, our family, our children, and so forth. And so I'm just kind of want to maybe finish up on an invitation. This can all kind of get really preachy, and I think it's better to keep bringing it down to sort of the real. If you bring to mind, you know, a handful of significant relationships, and you just think of kind of like a checklist, these five major touchstones for, you know, the sila dimension of practice. Safety. Broadly defined, is what's happening promotive, encouraging of safety for me or not in that relationship, including emotional safety, including the safety of not feeling invaded by the fact that other people won't stop wearing artificial products that give you a rash every time you're around them, or, you know, they come at you in ways that are just really invasive, at least for you. Flip it around, am I helping others feel less afraid around me? We're so afraid. Am I being threatening to other people in ways that are needless with my, you know, style or way or righteous critique or scary way of moving or talking? You know, safety. And similarly, looking at our relationships through the lens of satisfaction, goal attainment, wholesome pleasure, as well as connection, commitment to truth, commitment to fairness. I think that's a really useful way to come into this. And next week, I want to talk about forgiveness. I want to talk about forgiving others, two levels of forgiveness. And you can see why I needed to do the foundation today. Because forgiving what? Right? Well, we're forgiving stuff that's bad or wrong. Well, how do you know it's bad or wrong? Right? And what's good and right? Right? So forgiveness, two levels of forgiveness next week, as well as moving into forgiving oneself. Woo-hoo. Sound okay? Okay, good. All right. How about we sit? Another minute. Let it kind of sink in, and then we'll wrap it up tonight. Thank you. And by the way, I love being back. Thank you for letting me do this. Great. No, it's great. You. Yeah, that's great. Great. Okay. Sitting. And you can observe, very consistent with what the Buddha taught, that when people, including us, when we experience that our needs are met and we feel rested in what's true and rested in what's fair, craving falls away and suffering as well. Flip it around. When we help others experience that their fundamental needs are met, and that they too are rested on a foundation of the common good, a foundation of truth and a foundation of justice, for them as well, their own craving falls away, and with it, suffering as well. Thank you. Take good care.
Namaste.
Namaste. See you next week.
Back, you were on fire.
Oh, thank you.